Chapter 3 of Mr. Ralph Nickleby, and his establishments, and his undertakings, and of a great joint stock company of vast national importance, Mr. Ralph Nickleby was not, strictly speaking, what you would call a merchant. Neither was he a banker, nor an attorney, nor a special pleader, nor a notary. He was certainly not a tradesman, and still less could he lay any claim to the title of a professional gentleman. For it would have been impossible to mention any recognized profession to which he belonged. Nevertheless, as he lived in a spacious house in Golden Square, which, in addition to a brass plate upon the street door, had another brass plate two sizes, and a half smaller upon the left-hand doorpost, surrounding a brass model of an infant's fist grasping a fragment of a skewer, and displaying the word office, apostrophe, it was clear that Mr. Ralph Nickleby did, or pretended to do, business of some kind. And the fact, if it required any further circumstantial evidence, was abundantly demonstrated by the diurnal attendance, between the hours of 9:30 and 5, of a sallow-faced man in rusty brown, who sat upon an uncommonly hard stool in a species of butler's pantry at the end of the passage, and always had a pen behind his ear when he answered the bell. Although a few members of the graver professions live about Golden Square, it is not exactly in anybody's way to or from anywhere. It is one of the squares that have been, a quarter of the town, that has gone down in the world, and taken to letting lodgings. Many of its first and second floors are let, furnished, to single gentlemen, and it takes boarders besides. It is a great resort of foreigners. The dark-complexioned men who wear large rings, and heavy watch-guards, and bushy whiskers, and who congregate under the opera colonnade, and about the box office in the season, between 4 and 5 in the afternoon, when they give away the orders, all live in Golden Square, or within a street of it. Two or three violins and a wind instrument from the opera band reside within its precincts. Its boarding houses are musical, and the notes of pianos and harps float in the evening time round the head of the mournful statue, the guardian genius of a little wilderness of shrubs, in the center of the square. On a summer's night, windows are thrown open, and groups of swarthy moustached men are seen by the passer-by, lounging at the casements, and smoking fearfully. Sounds of gruff voices practicing vocal music invade the evening silence, and the fumes of choice tobacco scent the air. There, snuff and cigars, and German pipes and flutes, and violins and violoncellos, divide the supremacy between them. It is the region of song and smoke. Street bands are on their mettle in Golden Square, and itinerant glee singers quaver involuntarily as they raise their voices within its boundaries. This would not seem a spot very well adapted to the transaction of business, but Mr. Ralph Nickleby had lived there, notwithstanding, for many years, and uttered no complaint on that score. He knew nobody round about, and nobody knew him, although he enjoyed the reputation of being immensely rich. The tradesman held that he was a sort of lawyer, and the other neighbors opined that he was a kind of general agent. Both of which guesses were as correct and definite as guesses about other people's affairs usually are, or need to be. Mr. Ralph Nickleby sat in his private office one morning, ready dressed to walk abroad. He wore a bottle green spencer over a blue coat, a white waistcoat, gray mixture pantaloons, and Wellington boots drawn over them. The corner of a small plaited shirt frill struggled out, as if insisting to show itself, from between his chin and the top button of his spencer, and the latter garment was not made low enough to conceal a long gold watch chain, composed of a series of plain rings, which had its beginning at the handle of a gold repeater in Mr. Nickleby's pocket, and its termination in two little keys, one belonging to the watch itself, and the other to some patent padlock. He wore a sprinkling of powder upon his head, as if to make himself look benevolent. But if that were his purpose, He would perhaps have done better to powder his countenance also, for there was something in its very wrinkles, and in his cold restless eye, which seemed to tell of cunning, that would announce itself in spite of him. However this might be, there he was, and as he was all alone, neither the powder, nor the wrinkles, nor the eyes, had the smallest effect, good or bad, upon anybody just then, and are consequently no business of ours just now. Mr. Nickleby closed an account book which lay on his desk, and, throwing himself back in his chair, gazed with an air of abstraction through the dirty window. Some London houses have a melancholy little plot of ground behind them, usually fenced in by four high whitewashed walls, and frowned upon by stacks of chimneys, in which there withers on, from year to year, a crippled tree, that makes a show of putting forth a few leaves late in autumn, when other trees shed theirs, and, drooping in the effort, lingers on, all crackled and smoke-dried, till the following season, when it repeats the same process, and perhaps, if the weather be particularly genial, even tempts some rheumatic sparrow, to chirrup in its branches. People sometimes call these dark yards gardens. It is not supposed that they were ever planted, but rather that they are pieces of unreclaimed land, with the withered vegetation of the original brick field. No man thinks of walking in this desolate place, or of turning it to any account. A few hampers, half a dozen broken bottles, and such like rubbish, may be thrown there when the tenant first moves in, but nothing more, and there they remain until he goes away again. The damp straw taking just as long to molder as it thinks proper, and mingling with the scanty box, and stunted evergreens, and broken flower pots, that are scattered mournfully about a prey to blacks and dirt. It was into a place of this kind that Mr. Ralph Nickleby gazed, as he sat with his hands in his pockets looking out of the window. He had fixed his eyes upon a distorted fir tree, planted by some former tenant in a tub that had once been green, and left there, years before, to rot away piecemeal. There was nothing very inviting in the object, but Mr. Nickleby was wrapped in a brown study, and sat contemplating it with far greater attention than, in a more conscious mood, he would have deigned to bestow upon the rarest exotic. At length, his eyes wandered to a little dirty window on the left, through which the face of the clerk was dimly visible. That worthy chancing to look up, he beckoned him to attend. In obedience to this summons, the clerk got off the high stool to which he had communicated a high polish by countless gettings off and on, and presented himself in Mr. Nickleby's room. He was a tall man of middle age, with two goggle eyes whereof one was a fixture, a rubicund nose, a cadaverous face, and a suit of clothes, if the term be allowable, when they suited him, not at all, much the worse for wear, very much too small, and placed upon such a short allowance of buttons, that it was marvelous how he contrived to keep them on. Was that 12:30, Knox? ? Said Mr. Nickleby, in a sharp and grating voice. Not more than 5:20 by the ? Knox was going to add public house clock, but recollecting himself, substituted regular time. ? My watch has stopped, ? Said Mr. Nickleby. I don't know from what cause. ? Not wound up, ? Said Knox. Yes it is, ? Said Mr. Nickleby. Over wound then, ? Rejoined Knox. That can't very well be, ? Observed Mr. Nickleby. Must be, ? Said Knox. Well, ? Said Mr. Nickleby, putting the repeater back in his pocket, perhaps it is. ? Knox gave a peculiar grunt, as was his custom at the end of all disputes with his master, to imply that he, Knox, triumphed, and, as he rarely spoke to anybody, unless somebody spoke to him, fell into a grim silence, and rubbed his hands slowly over each other, cracking the joints of his fingers, and squeezing them into all possible distortions. the incessant performance of this routine on every occasion, and the communication of a fixed and rigid look to his unaffected eye, so as to make it uniform with the other, and to render it impossible for anybody to determine where, or at what he was looking, were two among the numerous peculiarities of Mr. Knox, which struck an inexperienced observer at first sight. "I am going to the London Tavern this morning," said Mr. Nickleby. "Public meeting?" inquired Knox. Mr. Nickleby nodded. "I expect a letter from the solicitor respecting that mortgage of Ruddles. If it comes at all, it will be here by the 2 o'clock delivery. I shall leave the city about that time and walk to Charing Cross on the left-hand side of the way. If there are any letters, come and meet me, and bring them with you." Knox nodded. And as he nodded, there came a ring at the office bell. The master looked up from his papers, and the clerk calmly remained in a stationary position. "The bell," said Knox, as though in explanation. "At home?" "Yes." "To anybody?" "Yes." "To the tax gatherer?" "No. Let him call again." Knox gave vent to his usual grunt, as much as to say, "I thought so." And, the ring being repeated, went to the door, whence he presently returned, ushering in, by the name of Mr. Bonney, a pale gentleman in a violent hurry, who, with his hair standing up in great disorder all over his head, and a very narrow white cravat tied loosely round his throat, looked as if he had been knocked up in the night, and had not dressed himself since. "My dear Nickleby," said the gentleman, taking off a white hat which was so full of papers that it would scarcely stick upon his head, "there's not a moment to lose. I have a cab at the door. Sir Matthew Pupker takes the chair, and three members of Parliament are positively coming. I have seen two of them safely out of bed. The third, who was at Crockford's all night, has just gone home to put a clean shirt on, and take a bottle or two of soda water, and will certainly be with us in time to address the meeting. He is a little excited by last night, but never mind that. He always speaks the stronger for it." "It seems to promise pretty well," said Mr. Ralph Nickleby, whose deliberate manner was strongly opposed to the vivacity of the other man of business. "Pretty well," echoed Mr. Bonney. "It's the finest idea that was ever started. United Metropolitan Improved Hot Muffin and Crumpet Baking and Punctual Delivery Company. Capital, 5 millions, in 500,000 shares of £10 each. Why, the very name will get the shares up to a premium in 10 days. And when they are at a premium," said Mr. Ralph Nickleby, smiling. "When they are, you know what to do with them as well as any man alive, and how to back quietly out at the right time," said Mr. Bonney, slapping the capitalist familiarly on the shoulder. "By the by, what a very remarkable man that clerk of yours is." "Yes, poor devil," replied Ralph, drawing on his gloves. "Though Newman Knox kept his horses and hounds once." said the other carelessly. "Yes," continued Ralph, "and not many years ago either. But he squandered his money, invested it anyhow, borrowed at interest, and in short made first a thorough fool of himself, and then a beggar. He took to drinking, and had a touch of paralysis, and then came here to borrow a pound, as in his better days I had done business with him," said Mr. Bonney with a meaning look. "Just so," replied Ralph. "I couldn't lend it, you know." "Oh, of course not. But as I wanted a clerk just then, to open the door and so forth, I took him out of charity, and he has remained with me ever since. He is a little mad, I think," said Mr. Nickleby, calling up a charitable look, "but he is useful enough, poor creature, useful enough." apostrophe, the kind-hearted gentleman omitted to add that Newman Knox, being utterly destitute, served him for rather less than the usual wages of a boy of 13, and likewise failed to mention in his hasty chronicle that his eccentric taciturnity rendered him an especially valuable person in a place where much business was done, of which it was desirable no mention should be made out of doors. The other gentleman was plainly impatient to be gone, however, and as they hurried into the Hackney cabriolet immediately afterwards, perhaps Mr. Nickleby forgot to mention circumstances so unimportant. There was a great bustle in Bishopsgate Street within, as they drew up, and, it being a windy day, half a dozen men were tacking across the road under a press of paper, bearing gigantic announcements that a public meeting would be holden at 1 o'clock precisely, to take into consideration the propriety of petitioning Parliament in favor of the United Metropolitan Improved Hot Muffin and Crumpet Baking, and Punctual Delivery Company, capital 5 millions, in 500,000 shares of £10 each, which sums were duly set forth in fat black figures of considerable size. Mr. Bonney elbowed his way briskly upstairs, receiving in his progress many low bows from the waiters who stood on the landings to show the way, and, followed by Mr. Nickleby, dived into a suite of apartments behind the great public room, in the second of which was a business-looking table, and several business-looking people. Here, cried a gentleman with a double chin, as Mr. Bonney presented himself. Chair, gentlemen, chair. The newcomers were received with universal approbation, and Mr. Bonney bustled up to the top of the table, took off his hat, ran his fingers through his hair, and knocked a hackney coachman's knock on the table with a little hammer. Whereat several gentlemen cried here, and nodded slightly to each other, as much as to say what spirited conduct that was. Just at this moment, a waiter, feverish with agitation, tore into the room, and throwing the door open with a crash, shouted Sir Matthew Pupker. The committee stood up, and clapped their hands for joy, and while they were clapping them, in came Sir Matthew Pupker, attended by two live members of Parliament, one Irish and one Scotch, all smiling and bowing, and looking so pleasant, that it seemed a perfect marvel how any man could have the heart to vote against them. Sir Matthew Pupker especially, who had a little round head with a flaxen wig on the top of it, fell into such a paroxysm of bows that the wig threatened to be jerked off every instant. When these symptoms had in some degree subsided, the gentlemen who were on speaking terms with Sir Matthew Pupker, or the two other members, crowded round them in three little groups, near one or other of which the gentlemen who were not on speaking terms with Sir Matthew Pupker or the two other members, stood lingering, and smiling, and rubbing their hands, in the desperate hope of something turning up which might bring them into notice. All this time, Sir Matthew Pupker and the two other members were relating to their separate circles what the intentions of government were about taking up the bill, with a full account of what the government had said in a whisper the last time they dined with it, and how the government had been observed to wink when it said so, from which premises they were at no loss to draw the conclusion that if the government had one object more at Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.